This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World. Whether this is the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live stream at kabf.org and www.acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on these websites and affiliatedmedia.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're talking to Aaron Schneider, who's a professor now at the University of Denver, but I met Aaron when he was at Tulane, and he has a new book as well, just out this last March, called Renew Orleans: Globalized Development and Worker Resistance After Katrina. It's on the bookshelf of the Katrina series. Welcome to Wade's World, Aaron.
Thanks, Wade. It's great to chat.
So when we first met, you were working on what I would call a mega mammoth database in New Orleans that was very exciting to me because it was a different way of looking at what the power structure of a major American city might be. Tell people about that, because it shows up in your book as well.
Indeed. It's the background for a couple chapters in the book, and it was in part the way I got into this project, this book manuscript project, and that is that in a conversation with Bob Sarasoli, who was the Auditor General in New Orleans when I had first moved there in 2008, and I was there from 2008 till 2013 or so. He said, you know, I've got a wall of my office that is covered in Post-its, and each Post-it represents one of the boards, commissions, public benefit corporations that kind of come up in conversation or in evaluations of the budget or in discussions of the way in which power and authority is organized in the city, but no one really knows what they all are, and there's no central place in which they're all taken account of. And so I just started collecting, you know, all of these different entities, and, you know, I call them satellite entities because they are obviously connected to public authority, in many cases created in public legislation, either at the city level or at the state level, to govern things that we would think of as, you know, public assets or functions in the city.
Airports and, you know, hospitals in some cases or whatever.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. Exactly. And so, and New Orleans and other American cities, there's been a proliferation of these entities, and so documenting and then tracing the history of them and their evolution over time. Well, first of all, New Orleans as an older city and a city with its particularities and the history it's gone through has an especially large number. So I counted over 250 of these satellite entities. And what makes them, you know, important as far as I was concerned was the fact that they do govern the city. They control things like recreation and parks. The hospitals, development districts, and security districts. And so these entities are part of what is public power, but they're hard to monitor. Their budgets and their oversight is not easy to follow. It's hard to know how, in fact, they're managed. And that made them ripe for things like corruption, things like hiding the real power in terms of the way in which things were done in public policy. And so documenting all of this became a civic act, and working with folks around the city, really just asking people who knew more than I did about the way the city worked and who was important to know was really helpful. And so, you know, I had a conversation with you and your colleagues and many other folks who had watched power evolve in the city over decades. And so I was able to put together this database that one can poke around in. So it's, you know, publicly available on a website, nolasatellitegovernment.org. www.thebeachclub.com. One can then look through and explore these entities, and you can kind of search by function, or you could search by names of board members. You can get to know what their budget is and what the legislation is that created them, or the oversight mechanisms if they have to report.
And many of them have a flow of tax dollars directly.
Yeah. So there's, you know, in the book, you can kind of see that there's a subset of them that get direct money from tax dollars. Some of them are essentially backed by the city when they issue bonds. So there's significant money flowing through these entities in their collectivity that approaches the size of the city budget. So as much money is going through these largely off budget. Some of them are on budget, but many of them are off budget. So largely off budget entities are actually controlling almost as much money as the city budget, which is what goes through, the city council, of course.
Now, did you rank of these 200 odd? Did you rank these in some level of importance, or you know?
Yeah. So what I ended up doing with that information was, well, first I wanted to make it publicly available, so this website is there, and anyone can poke around. As I began to dive in, I began to get a sense for the way in which these entities were organized. And so one can do different kinds of analysis to kind of decide, well, to what degree are some of these entities closer or farther to each other and related to each other. And what I began to find was that there were networks of relationships amongst these entities that in some ways describe the history of the city. In other words, when a series of these entities might be created in the 1910s and 1920s as part of what was the old regular regime of that period, a political machine that controlled politics in the city, well, they created a series of entities that were part of their way of favoring their allies, of controlling the public policy issues that they needed to control.
It was a spoil system.
And incorporating especially rising immigrant groups and ethnic groups. And so this was part of that machine politics. And so they set up a whole series of these entities. And you can see the way in which in their legislation and in the way in which their boards overlap, you can see a relationship amongst them. So part of the story of understanding the way these entities are organized is historical. In the sense that, well, there are some that are created in the same periods, and they share certain functions or certain characteristics, and that tells a part of the story of what's written into these entities. Another part of what I think especially describes the entities as they operate today, because, of course, even an entity that was created in the 1910s, if it still exists today, it will have been adapted now to what are the functions of government and the objectives that elites will put government to in the current moment. And so we can see now another way in which the entities can be characterized and subdivided, and the evidence of the data suggests that, in fact, entities that cluster together or that are networked together do, in fact, share some functions in this current moment. And there are, I want to say, four kinds of entity that are of particular interest in the current moment. And they emerge over the 1960s and 70s in one instance, and then in the 80s and 90s and contemporary moment as another group. And the 1960s and 70s was a period in which African Americans were getting the vote. They were clearly a majority in the city, and they were going to be an electorally important factor in the city, and in fact, everyone knew that they would become direct power holders in terms of the way in which elections were going to play out in subsequent years. And so two things happened. Well, one, on the one hand, you begin to see a series of African American incorporating entities, and these were many entities, oftentimes incentivized or structured into the federal programs that were aimed at inner cities and aimed to provide services to poor, especially African Americans in inner cities in the U.S. And these federal programs supported entities in New Orleans and other cities that offered services and in addition, provided an avenue to employment, to power, to a African-American middle-class bourgeoisie.
And so there we're talking about model cities, yep. OEO, community action programs,
exactly.
Whether Economic Opportunity Agency in Little Rock or Total Community Action
exactly.
in New Orleans, or even Delta Foundation received mm-hmm. a lot of these monies, who is our license holder in Greenville.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
That became important, and obviously
sure.
it disappeared, but some of the structures and entities still continue.
Yeah. Right, so those entities still exist on the books, and you can see the web of relationships that join these entities and that describe one subcategory of these satellites. Another one that emerged around the same time, and you could say that, you know, you can see the dialectic and the conflict written into the institutions of the local state in these entities, and that is that there was another series of privatizing entities. And so one of the things that the white elite, as they saw the writing on the wall, as they saw that they were going to be pushed out of electoral power, was that they created entities in which they could control certain public assets that were important to them, that were important possible sources of profit in the medium term. And so entities that would take a public asset like the Audubon Park and the Audubon Zoo and turn it into a private asset for profit or to make available for profit. And the way in which these privatizing entities tended to look...
Technically, Audubon was nonprofit.
Indeed. And
501c3?
Yeah, yeah. So you have a series of arm's length or slightly longer than arm's length relationship that go from the somewhat well overseen Audubon Commission, which includes some council members, and the budget is public and incorporated into the city budget. Alongside it is created the Audubon Foundation, which is a 501c3. There can be some shared board membership across these entities, but there's clearly a close relationship. And the Audubon Nature Institute, which is now essentially private.
Yeah,
the
okay.
foundation has some 501c3 rules that limit what it can do. The institute, of course, is much more distant from what can be overseen by the public. But all three of these entities are operating over these assets. You know,
get a significant millage,
and they get a significant millage. And in fact, if you look at the way in which their budgets operate, there's significant resources switched back and forth across them, which suggests that they are very tightly integrated, not just through board membership, but also through finances. And so, when the public backs a bond for the Audubon Zoo, it goes, you know, in some way through these entities, and that money then becomes available in this privatized way. So privatizing what had been public is something that has gone on for a long time. It goes on especially in the 1960s and 1970s as the white elite sees that they're going to lose direct control over electoral power. And they do a number of other things also. And these two additional kinds of entities that I've called ring fencing and globally oriented are entities that, or I should say dual development, are entities that also come about and take the special shape in the 1980s and 90s as the city's economy changes. So just to complete the thought, alongside the privatizing entities and the African-American incorporating entities, you have ring-fencing entities, which are in some ways geographically based. And so, you know, the Audubon Security District happens to overlap with many of these public assets. And this is a way in which, once again, many times white elite or at the very least upper class residents ring fence a public good like security or like beautification projects,
right.
Or development funding for a particular geographic neighborhood or area, and say, well, the public goods that are created out of the millage or out of the money that's raised in this unit are only going to be enjoyed by the members of this unit. And so what used to be a citywide function, security, becomes something that becomes ring fenced fenced within one of these areas. And so you start to see an overlap between what's been privatized and what's been ring-fenced. And starting in the 80s and the 1990s, as and in some ways the Audubon case is sort of exemplary of all of these tendencies, you see as the city turns more towards services and tourism, a final kind of entity, the dual development entity, I'm calling it. And the point is that these are entities that control the areas of the economy that are important to those elites, those factions of local capital who are active in tourism and services that want to integrate globally. They want to set up economic activities, opportunities for profit, use public funding to incentivize those activities so that they can integrate into global processes of accumulation. You know, the worldwide vacation site that is New Orleans is available to these folks if they can beef up the Audubon Zoo, if they can turn that into something that's an attraction to folks coming in from everywhere. So
at least that's what Audubon Zoo wants to argue.
That's what they, and they've gotten tax dollars and public backing for loans to do it. So privatizing, ring fencing, dual development satellites, they fit together as a cohort, and you can see this in their financing. You can see it in the way their board memberships overlap. And so when I came to talk to you, you know, a number of years ago about the members of the boards of these entities, we have these 250 plus satellites, and we have the memberships of their boards. Well, you can map the way in which there's board overlap. And so that describes power in the city.
We're talking to Aaron Snyder, who's a professor at the University of Denver now, who also spent time at Tulane University in New Orleans, about the database he created to sort of look at how this power structure was operating, particularly in the post-Katrina period. And I think you mentioned that you had left New Orleans around 2013. And we've seen some examples of what the problems of these institutions are. The library, for example, which also gets a separate millage. I mean, Audubon Institute lost a millage, which still shocked them, and they haven't come back to the trough yet because access to people in the city is not easy. It is a tourist attraction. It costs, you know, $20-$30, so they have the occasional free day. But libraries are sort of an interesting argument on both sides, Aaron. I mean, at one level, it's an important institution. There's a new book called Public Palaces by Eric Kleinberg, who I'm sure you're familiar with, about how important libraries and other public social structures are. And at the same time, back to the overlap, you have, you know, charges of missing money worth millions of dollars from Aaron Mayfield, a well-known jazz player, and his associates and others who, you know, once again, on a library board, supposedly helping raise money and whatever, and then doing other public-private things on old Aretha Haley, dryads about jazz museums and money missing there. You know, just you take them out of the public eye, as you're arguing, and you have these close overlaps. I don't know which one you want to talk more about, transparency or, you know, concentration of elite power, this is not just the New Orleans story,
sure,
is it?
Sure. In fact, there are folks here in Denver, where I've moved to now, who want to repeat this sort of an exercise. And I think that all cities, and in fact, it has been observed that starting in the 1950s, but also, you know, repeatedly over different periods, but starting in the 1950s, there was a real explosion in these sorts of entities in U.S. cities. It's in many ways the consolidation of what people talk about as a growth regime in cities, and so the notion that cities are opportunities for profit, and profit especially by valorizing, making more valuable the value of land. And so if the function of city government is simply to make land more valuable, well, one of the things, and as far as the local elite, that's the only thing that cities, you know, really need to do for them. The kinds of institutions that they need to set up are those that are least monitorable, least accountable, most powerful in those actions, in those areas of the economy that are going to raise the value of land. Now, then what raises the value of land does change over time. And so what are the interests of the particular factions of local capital in terms of the way in which they want to use public power these institutions, in order to raise the value of their assets or to create opportunities for their profit, does change over time. And so one of the things that I do think is important to note is that the post-Katrina story and the way in which public power is captured and distorted and turned to a particular development agenda is quite clear in New Orleans. It's true of lots of cities. But the fact of Hurricane Katrina, the fact that in some ways prior to Hurricane Katrina, this faction of capital that wanted to globalize, that wanted to integrate globally, was not dominant. They had to share power with a whole host of other factions of local elites and even some popular sector demands, meant that in New Orleans, this globalizing project had not taken off. And so what had accelerated what had happened in a gradual way in a number of in almost all other U.S. cities from the 1990s forward in New Orleans hadn't made as quick progress. But Hurricane Katrina did a number of things that punctuate and accelerate this process. And so it's the way in which this distortion and unaccountability of public power, making corruption possible on the one hand, but also making it possible for these elites to control those areas of public life that they wanted to, and after Katrina, emerge, capture electoral power also, and now really orient the development strategy of the city towards their particular agenda. And what's so upsetting and was so clear about the way in which this happened in New Orleans was because their power was unaccountable, their power was almost complete, was that they were able to impose a deregulated, high-profit, highly segmented, a highly segmented strategy of production on those areas of economic activity that they controlled. So it's the unaccountability is important, and it's important because it allowed them to put in place this very exclusionary development strategy.
So right now there's a huge issue in New Orleans and some other communities about things like the Sewer Water Board, which is not a private entity. It's a public entity, but it's one step away from really anything that voters or citizens control. And mm-hmm. sort of the classic story there is the Robert Moses power broker. Mm-hmm. He sort of set the model in New York City, and it's mm-hmm. been, Robert Caro and others have sort of dissected it, but that's still a very common situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Highway authorities, airport authorities, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. water and electric authorities, some mm-hmm. places in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that compare with private-public partnerships mm-hmm. that are so much a part of neoliberalism?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember how much you dealt with that. I know you dealt with it in your book around mm-hmm. some of the activities post-Katrina mm-hmm. and all mm-hmm. the money coming in. But that's also a neoliberalism phenomenon
sure.
in Latin America, everywhere you work
yeah.
and study,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So public-private partnerships are a way of describing some of these relationships. And so, I would say that the privatizing entities and some of the developmentalist entities, look like public-private partnerships in that there's public money being made available to private actors to perform functions that we would think
are
public, but in that they provide some public good, they address a basic need. Schools, charter schools, are a bizarre way to organize an education system. I could imagine a few charter schools in a large district providing some innovation or some variation or some niche offerings, but to have an entire system charterized is essentially to hand over a public function to private actors, and those private actors then do what private actors do, which is figure out ways to insert profitable activities into those seemingly and traditionally public functions.
You'll all of a sudden have a superintendent or principal of two or three charter schools making $400,000, which
exactly.
Is a princely sum in New Orleans. So we also have phenomena like when you were speaking earlier, the Wisner, the battle after you left, I think, with Mayor Landrieu and the Wisner Foundation, which had been one of those 1910 things, some money left that supposedly benefit City Park and whatever, and the city had a certain number of seats, and the family had a certain number of seats, and in that case, part of the fight was trying, on the city's part, to take that whole thing over. That's probably more rare that you find a jewel that hasn't already been, you know, put in somebody's pocket, I guess. But that was a bitter legal and political struggle still. But I don't know if that's common elsewhere, but it does speak to, you know, the sort of tech billionaires and their sort of winner-take-all strategy where they're now claiming you'll get social change and all these improvements based on them deciding how they're going to spend money in your city, like charters.
Well, and you know, maybe I could expand a little bit on this in a slightly different direction, but one of the experiences that I had, and I do want to be able to talk a little bit about the production side of what goes on in any city, but that is to say that, you know, as I looked at the way in which communities, people of color, working class communities, immigrants got together and faced this development agenda that was being imposed on them, one of the things that is common in situations of conflict like that is that you get social entrepreneurs, you get foundations, you get
developers,
actors,
developers.
Well, you get actors that come in and say, you know, well, we're gonna represent what poor people want. And they may be well-intentioned, but the bottom line...
That paves the road in a certain direction,
doesn't
it? Those good intentions.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what I found was that, you know, the leadership, the agenda, the control, the sweat and tears has to come from the working class. It has to come from the people who are being excluded. And they have the capacity and they have the power to lead and to organize these movements. And the reason that that's important is because, of course, when those foundations and when those social entrepreneurs come in, if they're the ones that call the shots, ultimately it's their interests that are going to be served by whatever solutions are offered. And so it was really important to document and to tell the story of those struggles led by poor people that offered an alternative to what that globalizing, exclusionary development agenda that was being rammed into the city after Katrina. And so,
well, you want to get, we don't have a lot of time left.
Yeah.
Is there one example on worker resistance you particularly would like to raise up as we're talking to people?
Sure. And you know, I think that what I did in the book is I looked at particular sectors. And so I looked at construction, I looked at services and tourism, especially the restaurant sector, and I looked at manufacturing. And I picked those first two, construction and tourism, because those are the boom sectors. All the money coming into New Orleans for reconstruction meant the construction and you know, just the basic housing boom of the period was where it was at. There was tons of money sloshing around, and this is what elites wanted to control. They also had long been interested in this tourism and services economy, and that was another area they wanted to control. They sought to use that control to deregulate, to subsidize their activities, to reorganize production in a way that would exaggerate their profits. And a lot of that went along with segmenting productive activity. So making only a few jobs available, and mostly bad jobs, low wages, bad working conditions. The few jobs that were available, they made available on characteristics like, were you white? Were you male? Were you native born? There were a few jobs available in these very high profit sectors, and they made those available only to a narrow group. And then everybody else had bad jobs. And if you were an African American woman, you worked in fast food or quick service, you know, restaurants. There was no chance you were getting into a fine dining establishment and getting the good wages of a front of the house job. And so this was the model that was imposed in construction, that was imposed in services, but workers do come together. And so in restaurants, workers came together, and there are some great examples of the Restaurant Opportunity Center bringing workers together, identifying the ways in which their wages have been dropped, driven down, their working conditions have been made more precarious and more dangerous, and they organized. And some of their victories were really impressive, and their victories came about, and I'll make this the final point because I know we're running
out
of time.
Because we also need to tell people how they can get your book and find out more about it.
For sure. And I'll make this last point about the way in which workers build power, built power under my observation. And that was joined up struggle.
You make a point about community labor alliances,
exactly,
which is very important.
Exactly.
And how do people get Renew New Orleans, Globalized Development and Worker Resistance After Katrina?
Well, you can find it, I hope, in some local bookstores in New Orleans, and I'll be coming in January to get to do a book talk, and it can be bought from the University of Minnesota Press website, and anyone who wants to get in touch, I'm happy to send them a copy.
There you go, and I'm sure all the regular online and other bookstores can get it to you. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Aaron Schneider from University of Denver today, and Wade Rathke. We'll see you next time for Wade's World. Thank you.